Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Wolfson. It's from Portland, Oregon. That's where I am. Tom is on his way back from Peru, and I'm glad to fill in for Tom. I thank Tom for that opportunity. Boy, he leaves me Black Monday to talk about. Jeez, Bear Stearns, Fannie and Freddie, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, AIG, Goldman Sachs, 71% drop in their third quarter earnings. And we can only hope that Black Monday is eventually followed by Blue Tuesday, November 4th, because this gives the Dems a great opportunity to get the subject back to what it should be, the economy here. And by the way, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, I'm not at fault. Alan Greenspan, former Fed Chief, I'm not at fault. John McCain, I'm not at fault. How about your pal Phil Graham, John McCain, who is Mr. Deregulation? A guy that you kind of have hinted would be Secretary of Treasury in your administration. We're going to talk about all this during the show today with James K. Galbraith. He's going to be with us. He teaches economics at the University of Texas at Austin. Also, Jonathan Stein of Mother Jones Magazine, motherjones.com, will be with us to talk about the political implication of all this. Got a great email from one of our Portland listeners this morning who said, here is my new supersized bumper sticker. I hope it sticks. Here it is. John McCain has driven the Straight Talk Express over the bridge to nowhere in search of the sound fundamentals of the economy. Boy, that sums it up. Pretty long for a bumper sticker, but it sums it up. John McCain saying everything is sound with the economy, and we've made such great economic progress during the Bush years. We're going to talk about it during the show. Your calls, welcome, 866-303-2207. That's 866-303-2207. I'm Carl Wolfson, sitting in for Tom Hartman. On that election score, boy, the polls are all over the place. There's a Gallup poll that has John McCain up by 2. A new Research 2000 poll has Obama up by 4. In Virginia, Survey USA, Obama up by 4. An Ohio Suffolk poll has McCain up by 4. What does it all mean? We're going to talk to a gentleman now who is a skeptic about the polls, and he should know. He's David Moore. He's a senior fellow with the Carsey Institute at the University of New Hampshire, and he was a former vice president of the Gallup organization and managing editor of the Gallup poll, where he worked from 1993 to 2006. David Moore has written a new book. It's called The Opinion Makers, An Insider Exposes the Truth Behind the Polls. The website is skepticalpollster.com. David Moore, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, thanks very much, Carl. I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you on today. And tell me, David, first of all, when we look at these polls, especially those of Gallup and the TV polls, it seems like most people have made up their minds. These polls are like 49, 47, 48, 48. You say it just can't possibly be that we have so few undecideds.
Well, that's correct. And actually, if you listen to a lot of the pundits, they'll say, well, you know, there are still a lot of undecided voters out there, and they're going to be making up their minds as the campaign progresses. And particularly, they're going to be very attentive to what's going on in the debates. So I think anecdotally, we all know that there are a lot of people who haven't made up their minds. But from a poll point of view, you take a look at it and you see all of these poll results suggesting that there are only, you know, 4, 5, 6% people undecided. And it's just really not correct. They're probably around 25 to 30% undecided, and they will be making up their minds. And so whether or not somebody leads by 2 or 3 points at this stage of the campaign doesn't really matter, because there's still a lot, many, many more people who have yet to make up their minds.
Now, David, how do they get to these numbers? You say in your book that they use a forced choice hypothetical question. Explain that.
Well, what happens is that they, the way they ask the questions, they say, who would you vote for if the election were held today? And then they read out the names Democrats, you know, and the Republicans, and then they say, who would you vote for if the election were held today? And the reason they ask if the election were held today is that this is a standard question that was started by George Gallup in 1935. And he started asking that because he knew that if he asked people 18 months ahead of the 1936 election who they were going to vote for, most people would say, I don't know. So to make it interesting for the news, he said, well, suppose the election were held today. The problem is that when people who are truly undecided are pressured into giving a response, they just kind of reflect the top of mind what they heard perhaps in the news most recently. But it doesn't mean that they've seriously considered the candidates, and that's who the candidates are going to vote for.
So what this means is the closer to the election, the more relevant the polling becomes. Is that right?
That's right. As you get, you know, a couple of days before the election, and
when
you say,
people are actually making up their minds.
Right. Yeah. If the election were held today, well, it is almost is today, and by then most of the people have made up their minds. And so ultimately the polls tend to converge. While during the campaign they could find, you know, a lot of different results and they can fluctuate all over, they tend to converge as you get toward the election. But during the campaign itself, they don't give us a very good picture of it.
Are there any other questionable tactics that you know of other than this these forced choice hypotheticals?
Well, sure. They could say to them, who are you going to vote for in November? Are you going to vote for John McCain? Are you going to vote for Barack Obama? Or haven't you made up your mind yet? But they don't ask that. The pollsters don't ask that. I was really a little disappointed because the Daily Kos decided they were going to start doing their own polls with Research 2000.
That's right.
And I thought, okay, this is great. But unfortunately, Research 2000 is falling into the same trap. They have only 3% undecided, and they're just essentially following the same old paradigm that all the other pollsters are following, which is, you know, who'd you vote for if the election were held today? And if you really want to get an idea of what people are going to do, we should ask them who they intend to vote for in November, or haven't they made up their mind yet, rather than forcing them into coming up with a decision right now, which gets a very superficial and not very accurate picture of the electorate.
Right. We're speaking with former Gallup pollster David Moore. His book is The Opinion Makers, An Insider Exposes the Truth Behind the Polls. Website skepticalpollster.com. David, you mentioned the bounce, and you say that the bounce, so such as it is, is really people just maybe hearing about Barack Obama during the convention, these undecided voters, or hearing about John McCain or Sarah Palin during their convention.
Yeah, I think the bounce is really mostly a product, I think an artifact or, you know, a fictional thing that's created by the way the polls are asked. If we had asked people before the campaign whether they had made up their, who they were going to vote for had they not made up their minds, you would have had a whole bunch of undecided people. CBS got at it kind of indirectly and discovered there were probably about 35 to 40% of the public who they considered to be swing voters. They got it kind of a back door, which I won't go into right now. But anyway, most of the pollsters didn't measure it that way. If you force people to come up with a decision during the period of the Democratic campaign, they're hearing a lot about Barack Obama, so there appears to be a swing toward Obama as the undecided voters mention Obama. And then during the Republican campaign, the undecided voters are more likely to mention the Republican. But the truth is that probably very few people's minds were truly decided as a consequence of the convention, and that they were just giving those responses because those were the names that they had heard most about.
And David,
so I think we really need to see what's going to happen as we move toward the debates.
The debates and the date of the election, November 4th. David, there's so many polling organizations, Quinnipiac, Hotline, Research 2000 you mentioned on the Daily Kos. Are certain polling organizations better than others or more efficient or than others?
Well, all of the polling organizations that you see, that you just mentioned, and all the other ones, too, are all using the standard question, who would you vote for if the election were held today, and a forced choice. They don't give people the option of saying, or haven't you made up your mind? So those are the only numbers we've got. There are some polls that I don't pay too much attention to, like ARG or Zogby or Harris Interactive, which I don't see very much there. I usually pay attention mostly to the major media polls, or Daily Kos, that's fine, too, the Eagle Hotline, but they're all subject to the same problem because they all ask the forced Joyce question.
David, I have
come up with too many people on this.
My next question, actually, Patty in Maine wants to ask the same question I was going to ask. So, Patty in Maine, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. You're all on with former Gallup pollster David Moore.
Hey, Patty. Hi, David.
Hey.
I'm cutting out a little bit on my cell phone, but my question is that what I've heard is that there's a theory that the people that are for Obama are underestimated based on the fact it's a younger voting demographic, and they don't necessarily have landlines and can't be addressed in the standard polling procedures. And I'll take your answer, my answer offline. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Patty. David, what about it?
Well, it's a hard question to answer right now because it's possible that Obama is, in fact, stimulating more people to turn out to vote. But that's happened in previous campaigns. We thought that might happen in 2004 with the Kerry campaign. With respect to the cell phone, and we don't know for sure. If it's happening, then it could be possible that the pollsters are underestimating the youth vote in their likely voter models. But I'm not too hopeful about that, or not too expectant that that's an accurate description. We'll have to see. With respect to the cell phones, let me answer that real quickly. It is possible that the young people with cell phones are different in their political attitudes from young people who can be accessed by landlines. But so far, the research indicates that there isn't much difference, so that the distortion is not particularly great. But on the other hand, the Gallup organization has decided to include cell phones as a regular part of its sampling. It's the only one that I know of that has done that. So the cell phone-only users are being included, but I don't think they're significantly different from the non-cell phone users at this time.
Hey, David, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking with the former Gallup pollster David Moore. His book is called The Opinion Makers, An Insider Exposes the Truth Behind the Polls. SkepticalPollster.com is the website. Hey, David, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Carl. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The number 866-303-2207. That's 866-303-2207. I'm Carl Wolfson, subbing for Tom Hartman today on his way back from Peru. We'll be back. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Wolfson sitting in for Tom. The number to call, 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. And, of course, Black Monday, we have the Dow dropping 504 points, and this will certainly impact the election. There's no question about this. And, you know, we've had a debate on the morning show here at KPOJ, 620kpoj.com is the website. We've had a continuing discussion over the past week whether we should continue to talk about Sarah Palin or not. And I want to get into that a little bit later in the show. I think we should keep talking about Sarah Palin, but in a way that takes her stands on the issues and lets us illuminate our values and our stands on the issues and really talk about how Sarah Palin stands on the issues and not how she appears for the religious right and the right-wing base of the Republican Party as an image. I watched Claire McCaskill attempt to debate Carly Fiorina on George Stephanopoulos' show on Sunday. And as much as I love Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, I think she let Carly Fiorina control that debate. Carly Fiorina simply talked about Sarah Palin as a woman and how women were flocking to the McCain campaign. If I were Claire McCaskill, I would say, but what does she do for women or against women? What kind of funding does she cut in Alaska? You had a guy, Walt Monaghan, in Alaska, who was the best public safety commissioner in the state's history, really going up against fighting abuse of women in Alaska, and Sarah Palin was one who fired him. Now, we're going to get into that a little bit later in the show, especially with Jonathan Sine at Mother Jones about how to deal with Sarah Palin. But right now, the economy is front and center. It allows us to keep the economy front and center and to talk about John McCain's policies and really broaden it to the conservative economic policies that have destroyed the middle class in this country, are destroying the middle class in this country, and policies that have put America at risk globally, competitive-wise, and in every other way. Now, I want to go to Joe Biden because he was in in Detroit yesterday, and it really went hard against John McCain. Here's Joe Biden yesterday.
John McCain has confessed, and I quote, I want to make sure I get it right. He said, it's easy for me to be in Washington and, frankly, be somewhat divorced from the day-to-day challenges people have. Well, he's right. He's right. If all you do is walk the halls of power, all you'll hear is the wants of the powerful. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that's why John McCain could say with a straight face as recently as this morning, and this is a quote, the fundamentals of the economy are strong. That's what John said. He says that we've made great progress economically in the Bush years. Ladies and gentlemen, I could walk from here to Lansing, and I wouldn't run into a single person who thought our economy was doing well, unless I ran into John McCain. Folks.
That was Joe Biden yesterday in Detroit. Let's take a caller from Detroit. It's AJ from Detroit, Michigan. AJ, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. You're on with Carl Wolfson.
Hey, how you doing? First-time caller, I just want to say I love your show.
Great.
Yes, my question is, I listened to her interview last week with
Charlie Gibson.
Hold on. Yeah, I listened to her interview with Gibson last week. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, and she talks about...
I love
about,
that you love the show. I've only been on for about 20 minutes. I love it. Go ahead,
yeah.
AJ.
And she talked about the possibility of us going to our war with Iraq and her using religion. I don't know about you, but not only does she sound like an extremist, but... my question is about Palin. Is she part of a secret organization we don't know about? Because I don't know about you. I'm not trying to accuse her of anything, but it sounds like she is. And that's what scares me.
Okay, AJ, I'll tell you what. Rather than speculating on whether she's part of any secret organization, although she did welcome the Alaska Independent Party, the Secessionist Party, and there's, I believe her husband Todd was a member of it, and she was with the Alaska Independent Party at their conventions in the past. Rather than speculating on secret cabals and all of that, what we have on Sarah Palin is simply enough as it is. Sarah Palin is so much like George Bush. I mean, Sarah Palin is trying to hide her, Bush and Cheney, let's just say that. Sarah Palin is trying to hide her emails, her public emails in the government, in service of government in Alaska, and she's trying to hide them. She said today that she will not cooperate with a Troopergate investigation in Alaska, and the reason of the McCain campaign is that it's now tainted politically, saying that Barack Obama is behind all the attempts to get her. And we all know the investigation of Troopergate started long before Sarah Palin was picked as the vice presidential candidate. More of your calls when we get back, 866-303-2270. And Gareth Porter...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
I'm Carl Wolfson, sitting in for Tom Hartman. He's on his way back from Peru. The Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the Teamsters fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at Teamster.org. That's Teamster.org. 866-303-2270 is the number. And as you know, last week, George Bush, it was found out, authorized U.S. Special Forces to conduct ground assaults inside Pakistan without seeking the approval or permission of Islamabad first. Joining us now to talk about this, which is critical, it's a critical issue in foreign policy, is Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter is an investigative journalist and historian specializing in U.S. national security policy. His latest book is Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. Talk about parallels. Gareth Porter, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks for having me on, Carl.
It's great to have you with us. Listen, I want to start out with just today in the paper, New York Times News Service, there's confusion over a possible incursion of U.S. forces into Pakistani territory. The U.S. Denied it. The Pakistani government, according to a senior official who remains anonymous in this New York Times story, says, yes, U.S. troops tried to land and were fired upon by Pakistani troops. What do you know about that today?
Well, I don't know anything more than you have seen in that story, but I believe that this does represent yet another step or stage in this process of hardening the conflict between the United States and the Pakistani government over this issue. And, I mean, the reality is that whether it's the military leadership or the civilian leadership of the Pakistani government, neither can afford to be seen as anything but really very firm in resistance to the foreign troops coming across the border from Afghanistan, U.S. troops coming across the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan to raid targets which the U.S. has chosen, obviously, unilaterally. This is an issue that is roiling Pakistani society and politics across the board from the tribal areas in the northwest to Islamabad itself.
You know, Gareth, am I correct in, you know, we found out last week that these special forces entered Pakistan. I think maybe 20 civilians were killed. It's my understanding this has been going on for years.
Well, they have been carrying out occasional, not frequent, but occasional missile strikes from Predator by Predator missiles, which are launched, with the assistance of drone aircraft that photograph the targets. But these have been few and far between, and they have now been increased dramatically in recent weeks and months. Those missile strikes have been increased, and of course, then you add on top of that, the raids by U.S. Special Operations Forces. And this adds up to a major escalation in violence by the United States in Pakistan, and one that is based on a very dubious strategic proposition, which is that you can somehow dramatically weaken or even defeat the Taliban and or Al-Qaeda by targeting officials with the kind of intelligence that is going to be available to the Americans across the border in Afghanistan, basically.
Now you say that the intelligence community warned the Bush administration that this could threaten the stability of the government in Islamabad. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, the sources that I spoke with, including two who went on the record with me, that one of them being Colonel Pat Lang, formerly the defense intelligence officer for the Middle East for the Defense Intelligence Agency, and now retired, basically told me that the intelligence community's Intelligence Council, the National Intelligence Council, told the White House last month that carrying out this policy that had already been proposed and perhaps even approved by the White House, it's unclear exactly when that happened, would result in the destabilization of the Pakistani military as well as of the government, that was a very high risk.
And the Bush administration also, you reported, wanted nothing on paper, and they're just not in sync with their own intelligence community. Gareth, how has this situation ever occurred in an administration where it simply ignores its intelligence experts? Has anything approached this before?
Oh, certainly, yes. This is not a first that the administration, that an administration, has ignored the intelligence community's position. Perhaps this is the most dramatic case that I know of, however, that the intelligence community issued a stern warning to the administration that the course of action being planned would result in, what was very likely to result in, a serious setback, serious deterioration of the security the United States is supposedly trying to defend. The case that I have in mind where the intelligence community was ignored is the Vietnam war. Where the intelligence community basically put the kibosh on the so-called domino theory, which was put forward by those within the bureaucracy, the Kennedy and Johnson administration, using that argument that there would be a domino effect to argue that the United States needed to get further into a war in Vietnam. The intelligence community said no, they disagreed that there was going to be falling dominoes into communism.
And
we
all know how that came out.
That's right, exactly.
It wasn't a parlor game.
I regard it as a very serious matter when an intelligence warning of this magnitude, and apparently with a great deal of clarity, was simply ignored by the administration.
We're speaking with Gareth Porter. He's an investigative journalist, historian specializing in U.S. national security policy. Latest book, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. And really what's at stake here, Gareth, if I understand it right, is we're doing these incursions into the frontier area. This is in northwest Pakistan. And the Pashtuns there are sympathetic to the Taliban. And the fear of the intelligence community, and I think you might echo this, is that we could actually push them toward uniting the Afghans, the Taliban, and the Pashtuns together.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the problem is, as the Pakistani officials themselves have been saying in recent days, is that when you carry out this kind of a raid, you kill civilians, foreign troops coming into Pakistani territory to do it, you inflame local opinion. And even those who may have been on the fence, even those who may have been standing back, trying to avoid commitment to the Taliban and their allies in the border provinces of Pakistan, the tribal areas of Pakistan, now are going to be drawn further into that movement. So there's even fear on the part of the Pakistani government that this could result in a higher level of attacks on Pakistani units by the Islamic radicals in the particularly North Waziristan and South Waziristan. So they regard this as something that simply inflames the situation but does not really help to settle it. I mean, and this is what I really want to emphasize, that the United States military simply does not have the ability, by targeting a relative handful of mostly local leaders of the Taliban or al-Qaeda, to really change the strategic situation at all. This cannot solve it. All it can do is make it worse.
Gareth, who do you think, in your opinion, is driving this agenda? Is it the Pentagon? Is it Bush? Is it Cheney? Who's behind it?
Well, this is a very interesting and very important question. You know, I think the White House undoubtedly was tempted to move in this direction by the political situation, where it's only got a few months to go, and it was vulnerable to the charge that it was not doing anything about this safe haven in Pakistan, which, of course, was sort of officially revealed and given substance by the National Intelligence Estimate of July 2007, the one that said there is now a major al-Qaeda safe haven in Pakistan. They felt that they needed to do something. But behind that is the lobbying that took place by, I would say, three distinct elements in the U.S. national security bureaucracy. One, of course, is the U.S. command in Afghanistan, which is sort of on the hook for the deterioration of the situation in Afghanistan, which is now admitted by everybody. And they, of course, point across the border to the safe haven in Pakistan as the primary problem, or a problem which has to be solved so that they have a chance of winning. That's understandable, but it also, in a way, you know, gets them gets them off the hook for the policies that the United States military has followed in Afghanistan, which have not been particularly enlightened over the last couple of years. Particularly, they've used a lot more airstrikes. They've alienated a lot more of the population than was the case previously. Second element that was lobbying for this is the CIA's clandestine services, the folks that do the covert operations. They wanted to be the ones who would be given the franchise to go into Pakistan and do these sorts of raids. They felt that they had succeeded in Afghanistan and that they deserved the nod to do this across the border in Pakistan. And they relied on some of their friends in the media to carry the ball for them, such as David Ignatius of the Washington Post, who wrote about this earlier this year. Then you have, of course, the Special Operations Forces Command itself.
Hey, Gareth, we're up against the clock here. Thank you so much for your work on this issue. We're talking to Gareth Porter. He's an investigative journalist and historian. Again, his book, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. And you heard Gareth talk about one parallel there with the situation in Pakistan. Thank you, Gareth. Thank you, Gareth, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Wolfson on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Music on the Tom Hartman Program. Carl Wolfson sitting in for Tom Hartman today. I have the pleasure to sit next to Tom Hartman every morning, every weekday morning on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon. By the way, 620kpoj.com, that's our website if you want to check out my posts up there. Also, I have a segment, a little feature called Mystery Buttons. I collect political buttons, put a different one up each day on the website, 620kpoj.com. Might want to check out that collection, a little history for you there. And also want to mention another website that is just up. It's called countthelies.org. That's countthelies.org. And that's put up by, Dems, yes, by Democrats, to kind of counter all the falsehoods of Senator John McCain and the Republican Party. And they're certainly flying fast and furious. So countthelies.org is a website you might want to check out. Let's go to Dave in Modesto, California. Dave, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. So I had a question. I always hear from the media that Democrats are better off for the economy, and then I also hear at the same time that Barack's planning on raising taxes on investments as well as raising taxes on businesses, or at least not dropping them. How is that better for the economy?
I'll tell you how it's better. Barack Obama's plan is better for the economy, Dave. What you see now, Black Monday is just part of the evidence of 30 years of a failed conservative policy in the United States of America. The beginning of the Reagan era, and you've heard Tom Hartman talk about this, there is no or very little regulation, common sense regulation for business in this country. What we have now is called a casino economy, speculators and Wall Street running wild. And who always picks up the tab for this, Dave? That's the question. It's the American taxpayer. You can go back to the SNL bailout. You can go to Enron. You can go to Freddie and Fannie. You can go right down the line with Bear Stearns and everybody else. And now the Fed is going to pump $50 billion more into shoring up the private sector. Now, you hear a lot about taxes. I'm glad you brought up taxes, because the Republican knee-jerk response is always the Dems are going to raise your taxes. What was the surplus that we had when George Bush took office? And what is the debt now? I guarantee you the federal deficit when the next president takes over January next year will be $600 billion at a minimum, $600 billion. What are we paying to service that debt? What have we paid for the SNL bailout and the Enron collapse and Freddie and Fannie? So you have to look at it in toto. This is a great fraud of the conservative philosophy. If you just take off regulation, business will flourish and the free market will have its day. It doesn't work. Supply side does not work. And, you know, there to me is no comparison about what the Dems will do and the Republicans will do. The Democrats will protect the consumer. The Democrats will have common sense regulation for business in this country that we have needed for so long. And by the way, another thing that the Republicans do is not look at the worth of unions in this country. They are so afraid of sign up. Card check sign up for unions. That's one of the reasons they're fighting so hard in this election, among others. Another reason is that Karl Rove and a lot of Republican operatives are going to find their butts in jail with an Obama administration and an attorney general that goes after their wrongdoings. But another is that businesses are scared to death, or the large corporate interests are scared to death, of unions doing what unions need to do, and that's raise the standard of the American people. Bob in Miami, Florida, listening on WINZ. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Carl.
Hey, you have to wonder what kind of a gullible idiot would buy into this pack of lies from the neocon Republicans that your money in the bank is safe and insured by the federal government when this country is $10 trillion in debt and about to collapse.
Yep.
I mean, what the American people are so stupid. They don't understand that fascism / Nazism did not die with Hitler. In fact, Nazism is 10,000 times stronger, and they have control of our military. They killed a million people, million innocent people in Iraq. Carl?
Yeah, I understand. And, you know, we had the speakers of the Republican convention wrapping themselves in the flag and the jingoism and drill baby drill and all that. What they are in essence doing are taking the sons and daughters of the people they're talking to, send them over to Iraq to be wounded and die for the corporate profits that then they don't want
they
taxed.
Control every aspect
Absolutely.
Of our country, the banking, the media, the energy, and now they have our military. When you lose your military, Carl, you lost the war. You know, and it's when the bomb's going to fall in Iran in November, I'm thinking. And that's going to be World War III Hello?
You got some passion. Bob, I appreciate your call. Let's just say, let me go back to what I said earlier in the show. Let's just talk about what we know. What we know is that the same dynamics that caused the Great Depression are at work today. And one of the great dynamics that caused the Great Depression, if you know history, is that people in the United States didn't have the buying power to purchase the goods and services being made by these large corporations. In other words, we had a concentration of wealth. A concentration of wealth in too few hands. Now, yes, we do have more safeguards in place in a government sense, but look what they have done to this. Freddie and Fannie, as you've heard Tom Hartman say, were created to be federal agencies. They have been privatized, and look what has happened now. Who is going to hold the tab for the bailout? It's going to be the American people holding the tab for the bailout. You don't have to go far. You just look at FEMA and what happened in Katrina. Jimmy Carter created FEMA to have control by – it was strict control by the government. It was made a quasi-governmental agency. They lost control. It went into the hands of cronies like Brownie, and you saw how effective they were in Katrina. This is the conservative mantra. They don't want it, they don't care about anything except the military and the police state when it comes to governing. They do not care about the commons, and we need to have a president and a philosophy back in office that puts government back on the side of the people and understands the value of civil service in this country. And let's go quickly to Reed in Orlando, Florida. Reed, welcome to the show.
Hey, yeah, one of the things I wanted to point out is, besides the fact that the deficit's going to be over $600 billion, like you were saying, is that the national debt itself is close to $10 trillion.
You know, usually I say both of those numbers. Reed, thank you, from Orlando. I usually say both of those numbers in concert, that we're going to have about a $600 billion deficit, and we're approaching $10 million in total debt. Thank you for pointing that out. And that has been built. Just look at the figures. And where was Ronald Reagan's measuring sticker? You're better off than you were 4 years ago. You don't hear that from the Republicans now, do you? Carl Wolfson sitting in for Tom Hartman. We'll be back. Jonathan Stein with Mother Jones going to talk about the political impact of this bad economy when we come back. Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Wolfson, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Tom on the way back from Peru. And look forward to seeing Tom back in studios here at AM 620 KPOJ in Portland. Get a lot of email here. I had a good one from Rich in Portland who writes, this is what he writes in his email. Dear Abby, there is every good chance that my 17-year-old kid just knocked up his 18-year-old girlfriend, signed Distraught. Dear Distraught, if you're a Democrat, you should be deeply ashamed of your moral failure, and the blame should be placed squarely on you, the parent. You're the problem with society. If you're a Republican, congratulations on the beautiful miracle of your wonderful family that's been blessed with this birth. Wow, okay. Hey, did you see who is going to be up next for interviewing Sarah Palin? Sean Hannity. Wow. I don't know if she can stand up to the withering questions of that investigative whiz, Sean Hannity. Should be interesting if Sarah Palin can withstand Charlie Gibson. Imagine what she can do with Sean Hannity. The economy front and center in politics, and we'll be talking to James K. Galbraith at the bottom of the hour. He teaches economics at the University of Texas, Austin. Joining us now, Jonathan Stein. He's a reporter in the Mother Jones D.C. Bureau. He helped write and produce the Mother Jones Iraq Timetable, which was nominated for a National Magazine Award. He covers the 2008 campaign for the magazine and posts on the Mojo blog. Jonathan, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. I had to laugh this morning. In fact, I mentioned this on the morning show in Portland, a couple of your posts. One, tell us about the incredible bad timing of one Donald Luskin.
Yeah, Donald Luskin is an advisor of the McCain campaign who wrote an op-ed over the weekend in the Washington Post saying that the economy is doing just fine. I mean, like literally that's not that far off from a verbatim quote. He says that the naysayers in the Democratic Party are using the economy as an election year talking point, and that they're forecasting all this doom and gloom because they want to win an election. But in reality, the economy is doing just peachy keen, according to Donald. And you know, conservatives will often say, look, the technical definition of a recession is two consecutive quarters of decline in terms of real GDP, and we haven't seen that. Well, I think Paul Krugman, the columnist for the New York Times and an economist at Princeton, had the best possible response to this on MSNBC yesterday. He said, if we're not in a recession yet, we need to change our definition of a recession.
Right. And you point out in your blog, in your post at motherjones.com, at Mojo blog, Jonathan, that who does Donald Luskin advise?
John McCain.
Well, how about that?
Yeah, the McCain campaign could not have been happy with that, the timing of that op-ed. But then, to be perfectly honest, on Monday morning, just as news was breaking that the American economy was in serious trouble and Lehman Brothers was going under and that Merrill Lynch had been bought by Bank of America, John McCain went on the campaign trail and in a quote that is now famous said that the fundamentals of our economy are strong. So maybe they don't really mind that Donald Luskin was out writing what he wrote over the weekend, and it's maybe because John McCain has advisors like Luskin who think that the economy is doing, okay, that McCain is comfortable going out on the campaign trail and saying that the fundamentals of the economy are okay.
And even funnier, if I might add, Jonathan, is the post you have up now at motherjones.com at the Mojo blog about blackberries. Now lay this one on us. It really is. I mean, you can't write scripts like this for election campaigns.
Right. In a moment that's reminiscent of the Al Gore campaign in 2000, the John McCain's top policy guy pulled a real boner. His name is Douglas Holt Eakin. He is the number one policy advisor to John McCain. He was asked by reporters to explain what John McCain's tenure as chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, or how John McCain's tenure as chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee helped him prepare for the current financial crisis, how it helped him understand financial markets. And Douglas Holt Eakin holds up his BlackBerry, which is like a Palm or an iPhone, and he says that telecommunications, this is a quote, telecommunications of the United States is a premier innovation in the past 15 years, comes right here through the Commerce Committee, so you're looking at the miracle John McCain helped create, and that's what he did.
So he invented the BlackBerry.
He invented the BlackBerry, exactly. And I mean, that's, you know, to say John McCain invented the BlackBerry is somewhat out of context, but so is the claim that Al Gore thinks he invented the Internet. He didn't actually say that in 2000, and we're still joking about it now, 8 years later. So Democrats, I'm certain, will find a way or try to find a way to peg this BlackBerry comment on McCain in the months to come.
You know, if I'm not mistaken, Douglas Holt Eakin, the guy you're talking about, is quoted in an upcoming book in saying that John McCain is going to basically have to raise taxes.
Yeah, Douglas Holt Eakin isn't a pure hack. He's not willing to say whatever he needs to say in any given moment.
He's
Joe
not 100%
Klein,
hack.
That's right, yeah. Joe Klein in Time Magazine noted that Holt Eakin is aware of the country's financials, and that in the, you just can't fund all the things that John McCain is proposing, and also at the same time make permanent the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, and then increase tax cuts for other folks as well, and introduce new tax cuts for corporations. It's just the math simply doesn't work.
Yeah, I put my pen to it a couple months ago, just based on what's on John McCain's website.
Yeah.
It comes out to, after the first year, $870 billion deficit. And they claim they're going to balance the budget in 4 years or so, or 6 years, or whatever.
What I particularly liked was when John McCain was pushed to explain how he was going to balance the budget, and you know he was having some trouble doing so because, you know, he's sucking money out of the federal budget by introducing new tax cuts for corporations and for the wealthy, and yet he's introducing new plans for dealing with climate change or dealing with you know, whatever. I mean, he has all these plans that every presidential candidate has. And when asked to explain how to square that, he said, well, we're going to fund my new programs by ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which just seems so counterintuitive in so many different
right.
ways. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He didn't say by ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said by winning the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if John McCain thinks that by winning the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, we need to spend 5 more years there, how does that mean we're going to save any money? It just doesn't make any sense.
Know, first of all, you don't win an occupation as we have in Iraq. And secondly, George Bush ran around the country 8 years ago saying he was going to balance the budget. He was going to have a humble foreign policy. He would never commit troops without an exit strategy and curb CO2 emissions. So basically, they say anything they want.
Right. And I will say that I think that that works to John McCain's favor. I think that the American public is accustomed to politicians saying what they need to say in campaigns and then reverting back to their old selves in office. The American public almost expects this. And so I think that there are some independents out there and some moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats out there who say, you know, John McCain has lied and schemed his way through this campaign, but he's a good man at heart. He's a maverick at heart. And when he finally takes the White House, he'll revert to being
right.
that maverick he originally
right.
was.
Well, Rick Davis said it's not about issues, it's about personalities. And, you know, that's interesting, the fact that this misleading is now institutionalized in the political process.
It absolutely is. And the American public is accustomed to it, and it's just affected the way that every voter thinks about politicians, I think.
We're talking to Jonathan Stein. MotherJones.com is Mojo blog, is a place to read more. Jonathan Stein covers the 2008 campaign and politics for Mother Jones, both the magazine and posts online. Which leads us to the question, Jonathan, who gets the advantage here after Black Monday? Do the Democrats get it because the word change is now pretty bold? Or does John McCain try to seize it and say, I'm the seasoned guy that you should trust?
Well, I think the question comes down to whether or not the Democrats can point out that it is frankly outrageous that John McCain is trying to play the role of the regulator in chief, that he wants to be the man to lead this regulation renaissance in Washington, where the financial markets and Wall Street is finally brought under control and the American worker is saved from the horrors of Wall Street. Because John McCain is a lifelong deregulator. He's always stood for deregulation. His campaign is run by lobbyists who have earned millions of dollars by lobbying for financial firms and from lenders that have gone under, like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And finally, his chief economic advisor is a man, Phil Graham, who went in the Senate, passed laws that were central to the deregulation
right.
of the 90s.
In fact, Phil Graham ought to be the poster boy for this.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's preposterous to think that John McCain is now on the campaign trail saying, you know, what we need here is more regulation, when he has been an avid foe of regulation his entire tenure in Washington.
You know, Jonathan Stein is our guest. You've written about Sarah Palin's faux feminism, and we talked a lot about Sarah Palin, and I know she's got a tough interview with Sean Hannity coming up. But why doesn't someone, a reporter, ask her, if she's so much against pork, why doesn't she give that money back to the National Treasury, the Bridge to Nowhere money?
Yeah, right. And why doesn't she give back the other hundreds of millions of dollars that she has for studying sealed DNA and so on? I mean, she has a number of pork projects in addition to the Bridge to Nowhere funds that eventually were allocated to other projects. It's a good question, but I don't know that it's one that really works for the Democrats, because I think that lobbying and earmarks matter less to people than the Democrats seem to think, or at least the Obama campaign seems to think. I mean, the Obama campaign, this is one concern I've had with a lot of his new commercials. I mean, his new commercials, his new advertisements have gotten tougher on McCain, but they seem to center on the fact that his top advisors have lobbied for oil companies, or they've lobbied for pharmaceuticals, or they've lobbied for, whoever. I don't know that the American public cares all that much about that. The purity of John McCain's White House isn't necessarily something that's going to swing votes, or the alleged impurity of John McCain's White House. I'm not sure that really clicked with voters.
I think with Sarah Palin, though, the fact that now she's not going to cooperate with Troopergate and other things, and I think, frankly, the interview with Charlie Gibson when she can, you know, she can see Russia from her house, as Tina Fey lampooned it on Saturday Night Live, and the kind of deer in the headlights look on foreign policy questions, possibly invading Russia. We've seen her approval ratings plummet, really, in poll after poll now. They are going down, so I think it is on issue and questions about her competence that are going to really make the poll slide.
Yeah, you're very likely correct. We'll see in a week or two if that bounce holds up.
Hey, Jonathan, we got to run. Jonathan Stein, MotherJones.com, Mojo Blog. Jonathan, thanks for joining us on the Tom Hartman program.
Thanks very much.
And when we come back, more of your calls, 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. Carl Wolfson sitting in for Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Good to have you with us today. Carl Wolfson sitting in for Tom Hartman. Tom on the way back from Peru, and glad to have your calls. 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. Let's go to Stuart in Seattle. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program, Stuart.
Thank you. On the military incursion by the Cheney Rove Bush regime into Pakistan, we need to look at the timing of this. The Cheney-Rove Bush regime doesn't do anything without choosing its timing for political purposes. Right now, the election is coming up. So we have to look at what are they doing there. What are they trying to achieve by going into Pakistan now? Are they going to go in there and get Osama bin Laden, that they knew where he was,
Great point.
For the last 8 years, and then make that our October surprise?
You know, I always thought the October surprise would be George Bush could actually complete a sentence before he left the White House. I thought that would be it. And you know, you probably heard Tom Hartman say that the invasion of Georgia by Russia might be an October surprise a little too early. But yeah, Stuart, you know, going in to find Osama bin Laden right before the election, wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah, and on top of that, if they can get Osama, or if they either do or don't, and they still look like they're not going to be able to steal the election, they could then arrange another 9/11 like attack, and then say, "See, the angry Muslims are getting us back for attacking Pakistan, or from getting Osama bin Laden, or something like that." They're laying the groundwork for something here, as they were in Georgia.
Okay, Stuart, thank you. And by the way, I don't know if you saw this from editor and publisher, newspapers, this is the headline, newspapers deliver millions of terror DVDs to subscribers in swing states. This is a 60-minute film made in 2005. It's titled Obsession, Radical Islam's War Against the West. And it started going out in newspapers, mainly in North Carolina and Florida, inserted in newspapers over the weekend, and they're going to distribute it in other papers. And I'm not even sure who has produced this, but it's it was shown by David Horowitz. I think he went on campuses and screened this, and shown on Fox News. He screened it on college campuses in 2007. But this DVD is being sent to millions of voters, obviously, right before the election, and they'll use any means. Don in Elk Grove, California, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, hi. Thanks for the chance. I think that the polling that we get is total nonsense. It's misinformation. It doesn't make any sense with the economy the way it is. And the war, half a billion a day. I think obviously, you know, you take Obama and Biden, and then you compare it to McCain and Palin, who have a combined brain power of an anteater. You know, and then McCain, let's face it, is a few bricks short of a full load.
Hey, Don, you're kind of breaking up here, and just let me, I got your message, and let me talk to you about the polls a little bit. I don't know if you heard David Moore at the top of our show, who's written a book. He was a former Gallup pollster, and exposing some truth behind the methodology of these polls. One of the things we didn't get to talk about with David Moore in his book, he talks about the lead up to the invasion of Iraq. Every major media poll showed Americans overwhelmingly supporting a preemptive strike. Maybe Sarah Palin didn't know what the Bush Doctrine was, but and this was absolutely not true. The media skewed the reasons for the war when they called these people up. All people were hearing on the media was Saddam, connection with 9/11, and people were giving answers based on noise in the background, and the polls were skewed. And they measured a top-of-the-mind reaction, is what David Moore calls it. So there's a lot more to his book than simply the polls that we hear around election time. Polls that really misrepresent public opinion on policy are extremely important, and they happen all the time, and we have to understand that. Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman, 866-303-2270. Coming up, James K. Galbraith teaches economics at the University of Texas, Austin. We're going to weigh in on Black Monday and the results of that, the effect of that, with James Galbraith. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-303-2270. Again, the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at teamster.org. 866-303-2270 is the number. Glad to have you along with us today. And it's called Black Monday, as I said at the head of the show. I hope it turns into Blue Tuesday, November 4th. And we're going to talk about the economy now and larger ramifications with James K. Galbraith. He teaches economics at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He pens a regular column in Mother Jones magazine. His latest book is called The Predator State: How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. James K. Galbraith, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on. And let me ask you first to earlier in the in my morning show in Portland, Oregon, I talked to Ellen Ratner of Talk Radio News, and she said if any politicians or person on Wall Street tells you what's going to happen next, they're lying. They just don't know. Can you make some sense just briefly of what happened Monday and the immediate response to it by the Fed and others?
Well, what happened Monday was the unraveling of two major investment houses, Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch, which then triggered a moment of panic, anyway, of deep anxiety amongst investors who held those companies' assets, who had doing business with them, and that led to a wave of dumping at the end of the day, and so the stock market went down by 500 points. What happens next? Ellen, of course, is right. It's a psychological matter. It depends upon how much fear and anxiety is out there, how badly the investment community wants to get into cash and into bonds and other safe assets. Yesterday, it was pretty bad.
You know, we obviously have a political bent on this show, and I was looking at Carly Fiorina's statement, who advises John McCain, and said this is a result of greed on Wall Street, and all of a sudden John McCain is going to try to grab the mantle, the anti-greed mantle. And yet Phil Graham, those two words, Phil Graham, Mr. Deregulation, is John McCain's buddy. He's his advisor. He's been talked about as a potential Secretary of Treasury in the McCain administration. How does he get away from that?
Well, this is a dodge and a bit of smoke and mirrors. The problem here has been a grotesque failure of the regulatory structure, which is what gave us the subprime mortgage boom in 2005 and 2006, gave us all these mortgages, which were referred to in the industry as toxic waste, people making the loans knew that the borrowers were not going to be able to pay on them for more than 2 or 3 years. They then marketed those off to investors held by pension funds, held by sovereign wealth funds, by all kinds of people, and a lot held by the investment banks, so they couldn't get rid of them. And that is what Lehman Brothers was holding, and that is what, when it tanked in value, cost them to realize enormous losses. It's really, I mean, it's not that complicated a story, and it is clear that the failure in the first place was the failure to say to the mortgage originators, no, you can't make a mortgage loan on abusive terms, and to say to the banks that were trying to sell them off as securities, no, these don't qualify, you can't do this, this is a dangerous concoction which is going to blow up in the face of the country in a couple
right.
of years.
I found it interesting. Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, said, well, he just said yesterday, I'm just dealing with the hand I was dealt. You know, it's not my fault. I found it very interesting that the past weekend, Alan Greenspan gave interviews before Black Monday. And in fact, I've interviewed him on the morning show on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, and he bears no responsibility or will take no responsibility for the situation you were talking about.
Alan Greenspan bears a huge responsibility for it. I mean, he explicitly encouraged the American public to convert their existing, refinance their existing mortgages into these adjustable rate products, save a little money in the short run. So but it's also a larger mindset or philosophy on Greenspan's part, which was opposed to using the regulatory powers
exactly.
that the Federal Reserve actually has. But the Bush administration bears the major responsibility. These guys have systematically desupervised the financial sector. They have put in place regulators who go back to the days of enabling savings and loans like Charles Keating's Lincoln
right.
savings and loan to defraud the public. These people are back in place in various places around the country.
Well, maybe John McCain has come full circle because he's one of the Keating Five.
He was one of the Keating Five. You know, when you listen to the Republican convention, it is very clear that the mindset of get the government off our back, or as Sarah Palin said it to Charlie Gibson, get the government out of our hair, is the mindset that prevails. Now there is a big crisis, and they're saying, oh, gee, a lot of terrible people out there. We need higher ethical standards and so on and so forth. But they weren't saying that 2 weeks ago. You can go back and run the tape of Mitt Romney or John McCain himself or Sarah Palin. They're very clear about where they stand on the subject of regulation. They don't want it. They don't want the financial sector to be supervised. The problem is that these people are left in charge of the country as they are now, the rest of the world is eventually going to conclude that it's not safe to put your money here.
Exactly.
And the fact is,
they're already deciding that.
They are making, yeah, they are and they aren't. I mean, some at the margin they are, but there's still a lot of foreign money here. A lot, the world economy runs on dollars. If the rest of the world decides that that's not a prudent thing to do, we're going to be in a lot more trouble.
Absolutely. We're talking to James K. Galbraith. He teaches economics at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Also pens a regular column in Mother Jones Magazine. His latest book, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. James, Freddie and Fannie, now all of a sudden we're going to have a government is involved now in Freddie and Fannie, according to Secretary Paulson. John McCain wouldn't necessarily agree with that philosophy, would he?
Well, we're going to see next year. If the right wing is still in control next year, Freddie and Fannie will be dismantled. The remnants will be privatized. The capital will be distributed to commercial banks, and there will be no more New Deal agencies helping to people who have good credit, conformable mortgages, to get this a stable secondary market.
In other words, they will use this crisis to go ahead and make them public completely.
To make them private. It's like privatizing Social Security.
Right.
A huge raid on a set of institutions that have for 50 years created the home-owning American middle class. That's why we all are out there owning our own homes, by and large, two-thirds of the country. No other country is like that. Fannie and Freddie are the reason. And, you know, frankly, this is going to go away if the right wing is still in charge next year.
And this is the heart of your book. Tell us about your book. I think the title tells us a lot about it, but why should liberals abandon the free market?
Well, I have a lot of respect for the principled conservatives that were my opponents 25 years ago in the Reagan period, because they had a coherent worldview, and they genuinely thought, I'm convinced, that they were serving a larger public purpose. I thought they were wrong, but I thought they were honest. This is not the case for the crowd that's in charge today and has been in charge for the past nearly a decade. This crowd doesn't have any of those conservative principles. They're basically there in government to serve private clients, whether it's media companies or oil companies or big pharma or big agriculture. That's who they represent, and they've turned over the government to them. What is the problem with that as a philosophy or as a way of government is that advanced markets can't work on that basis. An advanced economy can't work on that basis. People will lose confidence in it. They will lose trust in it systematically. It becomes a very predatory environment, a very cut and run, take the money and run kind of environment. And what liberals need to recognize is that we're not competing with Reagan's ideas. We're competing with Bush's reality. And right. that needs to be said very clearly. And I think by and large the American public is well aware of this and picks up on the message very well.
James, are there any conservative economists out there who are stating the truth as you just stated it?
Oh, sure. I mean, my friend Bruce Bartlett, who was my counterpart on the Republican side of the Joint Economic Committee when I was the Democratic staff director in the early 1980s, wrote a very good book called Imposter, How George W. Bush Betrayed the Reagan Revolution and Bankrupted America. And Bruce is a profound conservative. We don't agree philosophically on economic policy, but he sees what's happening in the world in very clear and realistic terms. There are many others. And of course, many of them are supporting Obama. They call themselves Obamacons. I think there's serious people out here who really believed in this philosophy years ago, who have come to grips with the world as it is, and I think they should be respected for that.
If Senator Obama does become president and is sworn in January, how far do you think he will move in the direction you want to see?
Well, I think in the Obama program, there are sensible first steps have already been laid out, and they relate to steps that would preserve and stabilize the middle class, housing, jobs, public services, public infrastructure investment. These things need to be attended to. Tax relief for the middle class. These are useful steps. How much further Senator Obama is prepared to go, I'm not one to judge. I'm not that close to the campaign. But I think that when you're taking the government of the United States, you have to take seriously. It's a very inertial thing. The important thing to get going in the early days are the steps in the right direction. You start taking steps in the right direction, then as you see the need for them, you can take further steps. You make have some successes in the early days, then down the road you may be able to have larger successes.
Hey, James, thanks for joining us. James Galbraith, our guest, teaches economics at the University of Texas, also wrote a piece at Mother Jones, How to Burn the Speculators. Why is the price of oil so high? Because the Bush administration did to the commodities market what it did to housing. It's a great post to read at motherjones.com. James, thanks for joining us today.
You enjoyed it.
Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman today. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Today, Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Tom, going to be back with you Wednesday through Friday from K Green in San Francisco. And actually on Friday, this Friday, Tom's going to be involved in an evening with Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon and Tom Hartman and admission $10 there in Broadway Studios in San Francisco. And TomHartman.com is the website. Our website, by the way, in Portland, 620kpoj.com. If you want to read some of my posts there, 620kpoj.com. Actually, put up a photo album last week. You probably heard Tom talk about Higgins the Cat. I went ahead and put up a photo album with my family and friends and 10th grade report card and the whole life of Carl there. If you want to check it out at 620kpoj.com, that is the place. One more website for you, and I think it's important. It's countthelies.org. Countthelies.org might be the life of Carl Rove, but no, it's to counter the Republicans and John McCain, all the misinformation they're putting out about Barack Obama, countthelies.org. We welcome your calls today, 866-303-2270. Let's go to Nicole in Oakland, California. Nicole, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, hello, Carl. To me, the current economy proves that the entire Libertarian Party is irrelevant, since their main platform is about deregulation and privatization.
Nicole, thank you for saying it. And I know there are probably libertarians out there listening to us. And you know, for me, it's always been there's some really good things about the libertarian policy. And you look at Ron Paul and what he said about Iraq and stop extending this empire, this American empire. You can agree with that. But you're right on, Nicole. If this cries for anything, it cries for sensible regulation of corporations.
I just feel like it's the current deregulation and privatization that's helped put us in this mess. And it just, for me, like I said before, it just proves that what the Libertarian Party has been saying all this time, this is really their fault, really. Part of
well,
it, anyway.
Well, I'll tell you, it's you know, we're talking to James Galbraith, and, you know, I think, and thank you for the call, Nicole. He's talking about conservative economic theorists and how, in principle, maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago, their heart was in the right place. But, you know, George Bush is doing what Ronald Reagan wanted to do but could not do because of a Democratic Congress, and it's awfully frightening. And we've got to make sure that the American people fully understand why we're in the mess we're in. Bob in Seattle, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Carl Rove and Carl Lyle Group, are you?
Hey, I'm not Carl Rove. I don't cop to that.
I'm just kidding. I'm
Carl
a humorist.
Carl Wilson will do. I'm the
I'm
good
a
Carl, Bob.
75-year-old humorist, the senior citizen. You know, I was very interested in the senior problems with our retirement money to retain our assets so we don't live in the street under the big bridges we have here with something called the, Fremont Bridge. I read it in there. What I was concerned about, Bank of America taking on such a large obligation of $20 billion for Countrywide and $50 billion
for Merrill.
Yeah,
and they can
for Merrill. And what about AIG?
Yeah.
That's a major group. I mean, these are major considerations, and we as 75-year-old seniors that want to keep our assets so we don't end up with a total.
You want Social Security, Bob, to be what it was meant to be by Franklin Roosevelt, and I thank you for the call. And, you know, the Democrats ought to be saying that John McCain wants to privatize Social Security, wants to take Social Security, your Social Security, and throw it into this mess we have called the U.S. stock market. They need to be saying this. I think Paul Begala mentioned it last week. They need to be saying it out there. These are risky things. These are extremists. Robert in Lake Tahoe, California, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Carl.
Hey.
Hey, I just yesterday got a mailing from John McCain asking for contributions, and I thought it might be a good idea because apparently they're sending it to Democrats now. For us to send back that envelope empty.
Yeah, let them process it. Yeah, I understand that in some cases the McCain campaign has gotten access, of course, to Barack Obama supporters, sending out mailers that want the voter to fill it out for voter registration or absentee ballot, excuse me, and then it goes back to the wrong address.
Well, this wasn't that. This is just from the RNC, just asking
right.
for contributions, yeah.
Hey, you can send it back empty, but Robert, scroll a message on there. How about that?
Oh, I did that too.
Okay, you're on it. You're ahead of me. I appreciate it. Let's go to Michael in Long Beach, California. Michael, you're on the Tom Hartman Program with Carl Wolfson.
Thank you very much. I just what has to happen for Obama to win is first of all, he needs to start sounding angry. If this business about angry black man, if you're not angry, you're not awake. But what they need to do, they need two commercials, one on his alleged national security credentials and one on his alleged pro-life credentials. First of all, it's not pro-life, it's mandatory pregnancy. And they need to attack him on the fact that both him and Palin are connected to Abramoff lobbyist, Abramoff, connected to the sweatshops in the U.S. Mariana that forced women to have abortions. These people are the this is the bridge to hypocrisy.
Yeah,
and they need to be attacked on that. And I'd like to tell you the national security one, but I don't think you're going to let me.
Michael, I'll tell you something. I appreciate one of the things you said in that. Well, I appreciate the whole call, but one of the things you said that Barack Obama has to show a certain, I wouldn't call it anger, but his voice needs to change a little bit. If you listen to Barack Obama's acceptance speech in Denver at Invesco Field, I thought he was terrific. I thought that when he talked about enough, you really felt he meant it. Now, he's leading a move for change. But I think if you say enough, you have to have the tone in your voice that you mean enough. And I really believe that he can up that tenor. I certainly believe that. Let's go, Dan, to Dan very quickly in San Diego, California. Dan, welcome to the Tom Hartman Show.
Yeah. We need to make a point of bringing up the difference between Palin and McCain. Palin to Charlie Gibson, he asked about the economy. She said the economy was weak, and that was before, bankruptcies. And then McCain, after the bankruptcy, says, like, oh, hey, the economy is strong. And they're just basically making it up as they go along.
Yeah. Look, Dan, thank you for the call. Sarah Palin is a gimmick. Sarah Palin is to go after women voters. And, hey, Rick Davis said it. It's all personality, not issues, and that's what they're going for. Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman. Later in the show, George Farrell will be with us with opendebates.org. We're going to talk about the debates coming up. We welcome your calls as well, 866-303-2070.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good to have you with us on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Wolfson. Tom will be back on the air tomorrow from San Francisco. Kate Green will be on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday from San Francisco, then back in Portland the following Monday. Good to have you with us, and we're very pleased to welcome the executive director of a group called Open Debates. He's George Farrah. George, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, thank you for having me on, Carl. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you on. Opendebates.org. Opendebates.org is the website. George, whatever happened to the League of Women Voters? I have to say, I was 7 years old. I remember watching some of the Kennedy-Nixon debates, and I don't know if League of Women Voters sponsored that debate, but I remember growing up, it was the League of Women Voters. Whatever happened to that?
That's a great question. The 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debates were sponsored by the television networks, but in 1976 through 1984, the League of Women Voters did in fact sponsor the presidential debates, and they, according to us, did a fantastic job. They demanded the inclusion of popular independent candidates like John B. Anderson in 1980. They refused to allow the major party nominees to dictate the formats. In 1984, when the Mondale and Reagan campaigns tried to pick every single moderator, the League of Women Voters issued a press release and scathingly attacked the candidates for, quote, sabotaging the electoral process. And the parties, the Republican Democratic parties, didn't like the fact that a woman's organization was telling their boys who could participate in the presidential debate and under what conditions. So in 1986, the Democrat-Republican parties ratified an agreement to take over the presidential debate, and they established the front group that we have operating the debate today, the Commission on Presidential Debates.
And so today, here at 2008, we have Lindsey Graham of the McCain campaign. We have Rahm Emanuel of the Obama campaign. They have negotiated the contract for this year's debates.
Exactly. Since the Commission took over the presidential debates in 1986, the Republican Democratic parties have secretly controlled this forum without much of the public knowing. And every 4 years since then, the Republican Democratic nominees get these high-profile debate negotiators. And this year, as you mentioned, it was Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Rahm Emanuel of Illinois. They got together behind closed doors in a law office in Washington, and they hammered out a detailed contract that dictates precisely how the debates are going to be structured, from the height of the podium to the backdrop. But this year, unlike any other year before, we can't get a hold of this contract. They are keeping it secret, Carl.
So the debate contract, and this is in contrast to previous election cycles, is secret.
Correct. I mean, in 1992 and 1996 and 2000 and 2004, contracts were negotiated, and our organization was lucky enough to have a whistleblower give them to us. We leaked them to the public. The press was furious with how these candidates were trying to manipulate it, and it created a significant amount of public discourse and criticism and pushed the commission to reform a bit, and they've improved as a result over the last 8 years. But as a result of this outrage, when you get a hold of this contract, the outrage at seeing the candidates actually manipulating our most important public forum, the commission this year, in complicity with the candidates, has kept it secret. And
they
right
just
now,
want to
our
keep the blowback at bay, basically.
Exactly.
They want to keep the blowback at bay. Who would be a better sponsor, George?
Well, we have been championing something called the Citizens Debate Commission. That is a collection of civic groups, including people like MTV's Rock the Vote, to Common Cause, and all these pro-democracy organizations across the country from the left, middle, and right of the political spectrum to come together and to host their own debates. The biggest problem, though, Carl, is the Republican Democratic nominees aren't going to show up. In 2004, we actually put together a Citizens Debate Commission. 35 newspapers around the country editorialized in support of us. We got sites at major universities around the country. We sent out invitations. And, of course, the major party candidates didn't show up because they want to participate in presidential debates that they have total and unilateral control over.
Yeah, we're speaking to George Farah. He's the executive director of the group Open Debates. OpenDebates.org is the website. You know, it's always great when you're either traveling in a European country or Canada, or you can access it through cable when you see their debates, because they have a number of candidates. They reflect such a diversity of opinion. It really, you almost feel it when you watch it, how healthy it is for democracy to have those points of view represented.
Carl, I couldn't agree with you more. Our neighbors to the north in Canada, their last parliamentary debate for prime minister position, had five candidates, including two minor party candidates, and this absolutely invigorates the electorate. It allows people who may not feel particularly excited about the Republican Democratic parties, which at this point a plurality of voters are independents, feel connected to the ideas raised on the stage, feel connected to the candidates on the stage. And it's really a terrible irony that this country, which prides itself on the free market of ideas, which celebrates a sort of free market capitalism and says, may the best man win, will not allow the same thing to happen in our political process.
Yeah.
Our organization doesn't push for a third-party candidate or a major-party candidate. It just says allow the candidates that the American people want to see to participate in the debate.
You know, our country developed political parties. Political parties developed first in the United States of America, and here we are in 2008, and it's been a long, you know, it's been a road traveled for a purpose by those parties to dominate, and here we have two political parties dominating the discourse, and it looks like, according to the Zogby poll that I saw, 55% of likely voters want to see Bob Barr, the Libertarian candidate, in the debates. 45% want to see Ralph Nader in the debates.
Exactly. You know, this is what bothers me the most about this whole candidate exclusion issue. If you say to the commission or to the parties, listen, open it up a little bit. There's no harm. Have some confidence. Open this up and allow third-party voices that a majority of Americans want to hear participate in the forums. They say, oh, my gosh, this is crazy. There's hundreds of candidates running for president. This will be a madhouse. We'll have to have a stage that's 6 miles long. And they're accurate about one thing. There are hundreds of candidates running, including Lobster Man of the Lobster Party and the Crab Man from the Crustacean Liberation Party. It's true.
There's a Crustacean Liberation Party?
Yes.
Sign me up.
But Carl, they're not even on a single state ballot. There's only four third-party candidates
right.
This year, four that are actually on enough state ballots to even mathematically have a chance to get elected.
Right.
So even if you have
the point is you can set a realistic bar and have a healthy debate.
Exactly. And they're just being deceptive, and they know it.
Yeah, you know, what about the idea, George, that these really aren't debates at all? I mean, this is really not debating the way it's structured right now, is it?
You know, Walter Cronkite agreed with what you said. He called these an unconscionable fraud. He said they're glorified bipartisan press conferences. And he's right. If you look at the actual agreements, which we have from 92, 96, and 2004, it specifically says in the agreement, and this we found pretty surprising, it says the candidates cannot talk to each other. Now, I have never heard of a debate where the debating participants can't even talk to each other. So they're avoiding spontaneity and avoiding confrontation. As a result of this, the outrage that erupted in 2004 when we made that contract public, my understanding is the commission has pushed the candidates to have more of a back and forth. Is it going to happen? We don't know because the contract is secret, so we can't even verify if the commission has improved itself. But, yes, for a dozen years now, we haven't had debates. We've had basically stump speeches that have been shown simultaneously on the screen with memorized sound bites.
You know, we got to the point, and I know this wasn't a formal debate, quote-unquote, but the Rick Warren appearance, we had the term cone of silence used. I mean, that's how far apart these candidates were, and I actually think John McCain was getting the answers anyway. But why don't we just build a wall between them?
It's absolutely, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's partly as a result of the handlers that surround the candidates. I mean, I put the full blame, of course, on the candidates themselves, and it's a difficult position to be in, of course, with this YouTube age and tens of millions of voters watching the debates, terrified of making a single mistake. But if a candidate doesn't have the courage to step in front of the American people and actually engage in a debate with his opponent, that's unfair, and more importantly, the United States, the people in the United States should be aware of that. This needs to be a more transparent process so we can all hold these candidates accountable. If the candidates wanted, Carl, they could hold a debate in their living room. No one
right.
can stop them. They can have a debate. The cameras would watch them. Tens of millions of voters would watch the debate. And we would know at least that John McCain and Barack Obama agreed to exclude a Bob Barr and a Ralph Nader, agreed not to talk to each other. But the problem with the way it operates right now is the front group, the commission, which is financed by Anheuser-Busch, Philip Morris, and other corporations, they take the heat, not the candidates. And we don't think that's fair.
George, what can people do? I mean, I give the website opendebates.org, but what can our listeners do?
Well, if they can sign up to our action alerts and be part of this growing movement, we have tens of thousands of supporters across the country, and we've already had a significant influence. Again, dozens and dozens of newspapers have backed our argument. The commission has begun to improve the format and push for more confrontation. They've chosen more aggressive moderators, and hopefully we can break the monopoly of the commission on presidential debates. Remember, these are candidates that are running for our vote, and as long as we demand things of them, we have power over them. And if enough of us express outrage and make it too expensive for the candidates to avoid a really democratic, inclusive debate sponsored by illegal voters or a Citizens Debate Commission, we're going to win.
George, maybe my answer is included in my question here. Why won't the corporate media simply put on a secondary debate at least with Bob Barr or Ralph Nader or others? And I guess the word corporate media tells you all, doesn't it?
I think absolutely. They know that a significant number of their supporters and their donors and their corporate owners are more inclined, of course, to support the John McCain's and Barack Obama's of the world. So rather than take the risk of exposing a Ralph Nader, a Bob Barr, or other third-party candidates, they'd rather stay with the mainstream press and mainstream candidates and advocate them. In fact, there's a telling point in the book I wrote about the presidential debates when I asked one of the network executives, why don't you guys go out and sponsor debate that's going to include a Ralph Nader or a Libertarian candidate? And he said, well, those guys think that corporations are evil, and all we do is employ people, so we like the way it is just now.
Yeah, won't let Lobster Man in. And, you know, money has corrupted so much because even the cities now compete to host the debates as if they were hosting the Olympics. Hey, George, you got to run. Thank you. We're up against the clock. George Farah is our guest. Opendebates.org is the website. George, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me,
Carl. Sure, we'll be back with your calls, 866-303-2270. Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman on his way back from Peru, beyond in San Francisco on K-Green the next 3 days for the Tom Hartman program. And good to know the fundamentals of the economy are sound, according to John McCain. Next time you look at your 401k or check the value of your house, just remember the fundamentals are very sound, according to John McCain. By the way, the Fed just voted to leave interest rates unchanged. The federal funds rate stands at 2%. You know, early in the program, we talked to Gareth Porter, who's an investigative journalist and historian about Pakistan. There's a Wire story The lead is Pakistan's military has ordered its forces to open fire if U.S. troops launch another air or ground raid across the Afghan border, an army spokesman said today. So, you know, we were talking about how the intelligence community has informed George Bush in no uncertain terms that these raids in northwest Pakistan across the border are extremely risky and can destabilize the situation there. We had one caller earlier in our show saying, hey, maybe they're trying to get Osama bin Laden as the October surprise. Don't put anything past George Bush in the final days of his disastrous and now lame duck administration. Scott in North Carolina, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you. I believe the debates this year, you know, so-called debates, need to be one-on-one and not somebody whispering somebody's ear like they did in 2004 with George Bush.
George Bush with his Karl Rove earpiece, huh?
Right, yeah. And that was the last two debates. There's definitely a transceiver on his back. So,
well, if you saw Sarah Palin, Scott, in the Charlie Gibson interview at all, you know, basically she crammed every talking point she could. These are notes given to her on 3x5 cards by Steve Schmidt, the Karl Rove operative. She'll pick out a key word from Charlie Gibson and throw in her soundbite. Basically, that's what happened, and try to avoid any substantive answer along the way.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was... Thank you, Charlie. Charlie, let me say this, Charlie. You know, I have to tell you, we also have to get a little bit better with our progressive and democratic representation on the corporate media. And I hate to harp on this, but on George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, Claire McCaskill, who's a fine Democratic senator from Missouri, went up against Carly Fiorina in a debate. Carly Fiorina, the McCain strategist. And I think she got her lunch handed to her. We need to be tough and turn these things around. When Carly Fiorina says that the New York Times is attacking Sarah Palin, and of course that's the code word for liberal New York Times, Claire McCaskill needs to jump in and say the two largest newspapers in Alaska say that Sarah Palin is unqualified to be vice president or president of the United States. When Carly Fiorina says Barack Obama voted present or whatever in the Illinois state legislature, why didn't Claire McCaskill jump in there and say, you know, where is John McCain? When was the last time he cast any vote in the U.S. Senate? And by the way, it's good we don't have him voting in the U.S. Senate because he's voted against raising the minimum wage 13, 14, 15 times. When Carly Fiorina talks about how women are gravitating to the Sarah Palin candidacy, what has she done for women? That's the question. Is she going to cut education and health care? Walt Monaghan was the best public safety commissioner they had in the state of Alaska, protecting women from abuse. What did Sarah Palin do? She fired him. So in addition to being more effective communicators, the candidates themselves, we ought to have representatives out there that really take these Republicans on and their talking points on. Richard in Michigan, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, good. You stopped me from a rant there.
That's okay. Let me give you something else to rant on about.
All right.
You know, John McCain served in our nation in the Navy, got captured by the Viet Cong, was tortured. As a prisoner of war, he was tortured and he broke. This is forgivable. I'm a Marine, and trust me, that's forgivable.
Absolutely.
In 2000, in South Carolina, Karl Rove broke John McCain, and he's been broke since then. That is unforgivable.
Yep, absolutely. And I've said it, Richard, thank you. And I have a post up at 620kpoj.com about that very thing. Any respect that you had for John McCain had to evaporate after that push-pull that was done in South Carolina against him by Karl Rove. And he literally kissed and hugged George Bush. I mean, this tells you he is nothing more than a party loyalist and hack rather than country first, as he calls it. And by the way, country first, what is it country first to send jobs overseas? Is it country first to pile up the biggest deficits in our history? Is it country first to put our planet at risk by doing nothing on climate change? And, you know, you talked about torture, and well said. This is a guy who's flip-flopped on torture. And, again, I don't want to get on the women of the View because they kind of went after John McCain a little bit, but they didn't go far enough. When John McCain said they accused him of flip-flopping, he says, well, I don't know how I flip-flopped. Why didn't they right there on the View list his flip-flops? He was for the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy before he was now he was against them. Now he's for them. And he embraced tagged Jerry Falwell. Now he embraced him for drilling. Now, before he was against it, He's flip-flopped all over the place. We need to hold him accountable. We'll do it when we come back. Carl Wolfson on the Tom Hartman Show. Your call's next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-303-2270. Carl Wolfson sitting in for Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at teamsters.org. Tom will be back on the air after his trip to Peru. He'll be on K-Green, San Francisco, Wednesday through Saturday. And then back in studio with me, proud to sit along Tom on the morning show. Tom's in for 1 hour with us. We do a three-hour morning show on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland. I thought I'd pass on a little bit of information what's happening in the state of Oregon. And frankly, the candidate, the incumbent senator here, Gordon Smith, a Republican, has hit a low that I have not seen in politics since Lee Atwater's Willie Horton ad of 1988. Those of you out there remember that ad. And it was run by Lee Atwater on behalf of George Herbert Walker Bush against Michael Dukakis. And Gordon Smith, the incumbent, is in trouble in the state of Oregon. We have a big blue state out here. The last poll had Gordon Smith behind by 2% to Jeff Merkley, the Democratic challenger. In addition, the negatives in that poll had a negative approval rating of 61, a negative rating against Gordon Smith of 61%. So he is desperate. And he has released a new spot across the state that accuses Jeff Merkley of conspiring to help a child rapist get released onto the streets. Now, Jeff Merkley is a father of two kids, and it is nonsense. Let's listen to this ad that Gordon Smith is running, one of two, on this subject.
I'm Gordon Smith, and I approve this ad.
Richard Gilmore, serial rapist of young girls, convicted for only one, because the statute of limitations had expired. Now he may go free, back into society. Jeff Merkley opposed extending the statute of limitations for prosecuting rape of minors. Merkley opposes mandatory life sentences for serial rapists like Richard Gilmore. Jeff Merkley, failing to protect our most vulnerable.
Now, as despicable as that is, there is talk here in Oregon that if this doesn't work, and I don't think it's going to work because it's galvanizing public opinion more against Gordon Smith for using these tactics, that he has more in his awful bag before the November 4th election. Now, Jeff Merkley's spokesman, Matt Canner, said that Merkley had, in fact, voted for the very bill to extend the statute of limitations on sex offenders that the Smith ad says he voted against. The point is he just voted once against passing the bill on a procedural ground. So what Gordon Smith is doing is taking one procedural vote, ripping it out of context. Now, this is a very common occurrence for Republicans in their ads. And in this case, trying to accuse Jeff Merkley of wanting rapists on the streets, it's a new low for Oregon. Jeff Merkley has his response ads up. One of them features a woman named Christy Gustafson, who's a police officer, telling viewers that Merkley does, in fact, support tougher penalties for sex offenders. Here's that ad from Jeff Merkley.
I've been an Oregon law enforcement officer for 28 years. Frankly, I'm offended by the lies and innuendos from Gordon Smith's campaign. Jeff Merkley has been endorsed by the Oregon State Police Officers Association. He supported mandatory life imprisonment and doubling the statute of limitations for sex crimes. Jeff is a husband and father of two children. No one is more committed to keeping our family safe than Jeff Merkley. Gordon Smith, knock off this sleazy campaign. We deserve better.
I'm Jeff Merkley, and I approve this message.
So that has people talking out here in Oregon. And let me tell you, there would not be this kind of ad campaign by Gordon Smith if he weren't in trouble. And, you know, Dems have a great opportunity to pick up anywhere from 4 to 10 Senate seats. JeffMerkley.com is the website if you want to go and help Jeff Merkley in this fight here in the state of Oregon. David in Humboldt County, California. David, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Carl. Doing a fine job.
Thank you.
I want to share a thought with you that all of these polls that we're hearing about now that suggest that it's very close between Obama and McCain, those polls are being tampered with. They're being tampered with by the same people who tamper with our voting machines during the election. I'm suggesting that anybody that has any influence at all, listeners, try to get the polling companies to take a poll on paper. Don't involve a computer, because when there's a computer involved, these high-tech goons go right through the modem. They switch the results around to make it whatever they want. They want to convince us that when they rigged the election, well, it was always really very close.
David, I thank you for the call. I'm not familiar with, of course, any computer can be tampered with. Any software can be inhabited. There's no question about that. David Moore was our first guest in this show, and he talked about, he was a former Gallup pollster with that organization for 13 years, and he talked about how the methodology forces undecided voters to choose. Well, who are you leaning to if you had to choose? And whoever is in their head at the moment, they'll say, because they're forced into this hypothetical. It's a forced hypothetical. So you have skewed results to begin with. And let me also add that the media loves their narratives, the corporate media. I'm reading a headline right now off the web that said Obama regaining ground in national tracking polls. And the Gallup poll has him, Obama, within one of McCain now, 47-46. The Hotline poll has Obama ahead by four now. And I think Jonathan Stein, who was also our guest on Mother Jones, has blogged about this, how now the corporate media is going to say, well, Barack Obama is down, but now he's fighting back, and he's going to make a charge. So they have interest in the campaign with these little who's ahead, who's behind, who can catch up horse race narratives. So, you know, what's important is to get out and vote. It's turnout that's going to decide this election. Tim in Detroit, Michigan, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
How are you doing? You're doing a great job.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about kind of the Democratic campaign in general, and I guess you can go either the Senate races or the congressional races, or for that matter, the Obama campaign. You know, I've listened to Air America for a long time, and I've listened to other liberal stations for a long time, and all the talk show hosts, whatever the differences, do a fine job in exposing just the lies and flip-flops of the Republicans. You know, the whole ideology, the whole philosophy. And what angers me about the Democrats is they never do this in their ads. They don't do this enough in their debates. You know, you talked about Claire McCaskill debating Fiorina, one of these Sunday shows. They never debate.
They just sit there.
They don't even challenge, for example, John McCain's war service in Vietnam, the whole narrative that he was tortured. I mean, that's highly questionable. And the Democrats, if they want to win, they need to go negative. That's the only way I think they can win.
Well, of course, the Barack Obama narrative is to be above the fray, but there's talk now that 527s that are going to be unleashed on him might be employed by the Democratic Party. But, Tim, I appreciate your point, and I agree with you. I listen to Air America Radio. I host a progressive show, and I can tell you we delve into issues every day on the air that the corporate media simply won't touch. Let me tell you something. If Sarah Palin, and I know the New York Times had this story about how she really governs in Alaska, and she appointed a high school classmate, this Francie Havemeister, to a $95,000 a year directorship, State Division of Agriculture, and Ms. Havemeister cited her childhood love of cows as a qualification for running the agency. Now, the fact that this was in the New York Times is good, but why don't we see the Democrats say, you want another brownie? You want another heck of a job brownie? Is that what you want? You want more cronyism? The fact that Sarah Palin could sit in front of Charlie Gibson and say that, yes, we would attack Russia if Georgia were part or the Ukraine were part of NATO. Who else would say that? No candidate who knows foreign policy or has any sanity would telegraph to a foe what we could do, especially if nuclear warheads were involved. To me, that disqualifies her right there from being not only a heartbeat away from the president, but president. Why aren't Democrats driving that home? We are. Barbara, in
yes.
my hometown of Portland, Oregon, my town now. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, Carl.
I wanted to know something. How do we go about, I know here in Oregon, we don't have to worry about our voting because we vote by mail.
We vote by mail on paper. That's indeed.
Yes, on paper. But the rest of the country doesn't have this opportunity. They have to go into polling stations. I was wondering, how could we go about getting November 4th to be a holiday?
You know, Barbara, it's a great question, and we've addressed it often on the morning show, and I thank you very much for it, because we do vote by mail here, and I believe some states do have, well, they have absentee ballot and maybe some early voting. But look, Tom Hartman calls voting the heartbeat, the beating heart of our democracy. It is the franchise, and we have to protect it. And you saw what happened and what happens in Ohio 4 years ago and what happens every election cycle. It's in the poorer areas where they don't have enough machines. Machines are broken down, where people have to stand in lines, people who have to work 2-3 jobs who don't have time to stand on a Tuesday in line. And yet they do line up for their franchise. They do line up for it. We have talked about for years debating, give us a national holiday for people to vote. Give us a week to vote, 3 days to vote. Expand it. You look at who opposes these things, and I'll tell you who opposes these things, the entrenched interests, especially in the Republican Party. They are the ones who want photo ID. They are the ones in Indiana and Wisconsin and the other states right now who are making it as hard as possible for African Americans to cast their ballots. It's Jim Crow updated. Don't take my word for it. Check Newsweek magazine. Even a mainstream publication like Newsweek magazine is talking about how Republicans are going about systematically, as they did in 2000 and 2004, to disenfranchise African-American voters and caging. Judy in Arizona, welcome to the Tom Hartman Show.
Hi, Carl. Good job.
Thank you.
Pointed out on Carl Rove on Sunday on Sunday News with Chris Wallace, Fox
Yes.
News with Chris Wallace. He was talking about the ads, and he said the ads won't work. What will influence this election is an international crisis, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, that's Karl Rove for you.
You know, so, you know,
so that tells
like,
you who's advising the McCain campaign. Who's the Machiavellian person behind it?
Yeah, I'm hearing about this pack. Another thing.
Hey, Judy, we're up against the clock. I'm sorry this time.
Oh,
we're up against the clock.
Cross in the sand is gone.
Okay. Thank you, Judy. Karl Rove saying even John McCain has gone too far. Well, you know, he should know. He's scripting the campaign. Carl Wolfson in for Tom Hartman. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-303-2270. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Wolfson. Thank you, Tom, for letting me host the show here, your national show. Tom will be back on the air from Green 960 in San Francisco the next 3 days, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And just want to mention again, if you want to check out my blog, 620kpoj.com, 620kpoj.com. Also, countthelies.org is a great website that is now up, countthelies.org, to respond to the Republicans. Of course, their whole campaign, Divide and Distract, Fear and Smear. I've been calling it on the morning show the campaign to nowhere, and I think that's a pretty good description of how they're running this campaign. Joining us now, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Ellen, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, thank you so much. It's nice to talk to you twice in one day.
Twice in one day, Ellen.
That's right. Interesting, today there was a hearing of FBI Director Mueller. And he was asked by Congresswoman Maxine Waters about the allegation that voters are going to be challenged at polling places if their homes have been foreclosed on,
right,
also known as caging. He claimed he didn't know anything about this.
Oh, man. Yeah, and you know, what would Mike Mukasey, the Attorney General, do anyway? Nothing.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're not in this administration. I don't think we're going to see anything like
right.
that.
I'm glad that this is brought up. And I actually said on the morning show today and maybe yesterday as well, the Democrats and progressives better have a battery of lawyers out there to combat this right now, because this stuff is going on before our very eyes.
Yeah, very, very much so. So I think that really actually shocked people. Apparently, he did not also know the name of the person that is in charge of minority and other kinds of enforcement in the department.
This is the FBI director.
That's right.
Didn't know his name.
Didn't know his name before he referred to him.
Nothing surprises me, Ellen. Shock me.
Right. He said, well, we referred all cases to him, but did not know his name.
Pretty amazing. Now, I understand that the Fed are going to leave interest rates alone.
That's right, and the stock market promptly dropped. What did it drop, folks, about 100 points? It went right down as soon as that was announced.
Yeah. So, you said earlier on the show, and in fact, I quoted you when we had James Galbraith on, an economics professor at the University of Texas, and he totally agreed with you that if people on Wall Street and in Washington tell you what's going to happen, they don't know.
They don't know. And that's the thing. I mean, everybody's saying, well, we've hit the bottom, et cetera, but nobody really knows where this economy is going, and unless you have a crystal ball that's accurate, you're not going to know.
Go ahead, Ellen.
A few other interesting things. The House is going to be taking up the energy bill that would expand offshore drilling. They're expected, the Republicans are grumbling, but I think the Democrats may have actually sort of boxed them in on this one. So now they can't say Democrats are not voting for drilling, you know, drilled baby drill, which is their moniker. And don't know what would happen to that in terms of the Senate, but that is definitely going to be happening. Also,
you know, the compromise is to allow some offshore drilling more than 50 miles away as a compromise, and Republicans would have to give up some things. However, I have seen reports that Bill Nelson, the Democratic senator from Florida, says he will filibuster any attempt to open up the shores of western Florida.
Right. But the issue is that you can leave it up to the states and have the states decide, let them do it on a state basis. I mean, that's what the Democrats and several of the Republicans will argue about.
Yeah, Boehner, who's the House Minority Leader, his whole thing is to allow all this royalty and lease revenue to go to the coastal states, and then they can use it as they want. But that's no way they run an energy policy, and who knows what they're going to do with that money.
For sure. Also, very interesting, there was a CNN interview this morning on Joe Biden. Both Biden and the McCain camp took to the morning shows, but Joe Biden is saying that the middle class is dying. That's not terribly surprising. If the Democrats can make that really a focus, they can do very well with that.
You know, I was very impressed, and we played a sound clip earlier in this show of Joe Biden in Detroit yesterday. He really seemed to be on fire, and it's nice to see the focus at least a little bit back on Joe Biden. You know, I've seen reports there's only six reporters traveling with him. You know how gregarious he is, and the whole pack of them are following Sarah Palin. So this is an opportunity for Democrats to get the spotlight back on the economy, back on them. But the point is, they have to take advantage.
I'm just blogging about that as we speak.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. The flip side is the Democrats better lay out very clearly not only where the blame lies for the situation we're in, which is clearly with conservative economic policy, but lay out a plan for the future so the American people can trust them.
What's interesting also is that you're having some Republicans knowing, you know, so goes Ohio, so goes the nation, as we like to say, that are sort of moving towards the middle about this. Interestingly enough, Senator Voinovich of Ohio, as you know, is said that former senator, I mean, I guess he's still there, right?
Yes, and he's a more reasonable Republican.
Yes, and he said that he's very concerned about that neither presidential campaign has dealt with the oil issue and the debt. He's saying the problem they're not talking about is that 50% of the debt is owned by foreign countries, 70% is being bought by the Chinese, the Japanese, and OPEC nations. And he said he likened the situation to a business whose competitors have a supply that's in demand and control of their debt. And he said that in those circumstances, it is doubtful we will be in business that much longer. He's one of the few people that's really singing that song.
Yeah. You know, John McCain also said today that, workers are the heart and soul of the American economy. And why is he sending their jobs overseas, for God's sakes? you know. Ellen, always a pleasure to speak to you. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com, one of the best in the business. Thanks for joining
Thank
us on
you.
The Tom Hartman program. Hey, Carl Wolfson with you. I've enjoyed filling in for Tom, and he will be on tomorrow from Green 960 in San Francisco. Remember, an evening with Norman Solomon and Tom Hartman. That's Friday in San Francisco. Get information at tomhartman.com. Enjoyed all the calls today. Having you along with me, Carl Wolfson, in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. It's your country. Get out there and take it back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.